couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about new movies, A Haunting in Venice, Very Short Treks, Elevator Game, Hypnotic, and Killing It Season 2. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Dawn of the Dead. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can find me on Blue Sky and Mastodon at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The Nun 2 won the weekend with $32 to $33 million. It was 32.6, which is actually really good. I mean, it turns out that horror movies still tend to do well, even in if they're getting middling reviews. And that's a great number for a horror movie. The thing is, it's not nearly as close to what the original Nun did 5 years ago. That one came out with a opening weekend box office north of $50 million. Yeah, that's a huge dip down. I mean, still $32 million for a small production like that is good, and Warner Brothers is certainly taking a win, but that's showing that, you know, there's less steam in this stuff right now. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is a communication I got from a listener, Chris from Tarpon Springs in Florida, and he was asking me about horror movies, because, of course, it's fall, it's September, and that means it's time for at least me to start watching the horror movies. I'm getting into the Halloween spirit. And he was talking about how over the years he's kind of gotten sensitized to certain things in horror movies and how there's movies. And I mean, there's sometimes silly movies, like he talked about The Ghoulies, that actually bothers him now to watch. And so his question is, do you ever find getting older makes you more sensitive to certain types of horror? And that's an interesting question, because horror is one of the few genres that will make you get upset. It's meant to disturb you. A romance is supposed to kind of sweep you off your feet and give you, you know, tingly feelings, and comedies make you laugh, and you know, drama similarly can make you cry, but you can get that emotional release. But horror movies are meant to disturb you, and they're meant to be uncomfortable. And I actually have had an argument with a friend of mine over the years about what constitutes horror, because to him, if it's just makes you feel uneasy or unsettled, or you, he's like, the point is you're supposed to feel uncomfortable. And so he tends to like these movies that involve some, you know, pretty graphic depiction of assault and violence and very realistic things. Whereas I talked about this with The Nun 2 last week, you lose the "it could happen" feel to it when a movie like The Nun 2 gets too big. And to me, that's the horror, the unknown, that oh, maybe this could happen. Am I vulnerable in some way? And I've talked about the difference between the remake or the new Evil Dead, Evil Dead Rise, and the original Evil Dead. What made the original Evil Dead so unnerving is it was just these normal kids going on a weekend jaunt to a cabin, whereas Evil Dead Rise is about a family that's arguing, and they're in a poverty-stricken area, and you know they're already at risk. But when you take the perfect family and you put them in a horror situation, that gets very unnerving. That's why home invasion movies, I think, do so well. But to Chris's question, horror is very personal. It is very intimate. And what is scary to one person is not scary to another. And that's okay. That's the nature of the beast. That's why you can get a movie with an incredibly low cinema score and incredibly low audience ratings do very well as a horror movie, because everybody takes it differently. Now, when I get older, well, first of all, there's certain things I don't particularly like. I don't like too much sexual assault in a movie. I don't want to just watch brutality. I don't want to watch bad things happen to good people for reasons they can't overcome. That to me is unpleasant. There's too much of that happening in the real world. Why do I want to subject myself to that in my escape? But outside of that, I don't know if I've gotten more sensitive to it, because I do get sensitive, but I certainly watch movies differently. The best example I can think of is the Nightmare on Elm Street series. I was a teenager when that came out. I saw the first couple ones on VHS. But, you know, like, by the time the fourth one was rolling around, I was going to see him in the theaters as a teenager. And so I watched them completely as a teenager. You watch a movie as yourself. You put yourself in the main character's situation. Well, a couple of years ago, I went back and I rewatched a bunch of the old Nightmare on Elm Street movies, the original ones. And especially the first one, as an adult who has teenage children, you're suddenly starting to look at that not as the teenager, but you're looking at it as the parents. And Nightmare on Elm Street in particular is a great example of a movie that means very different things to the teenagers and the victims versus the parents who were the ones who originally went after Freddy Krueger to protect their kids. And it's a movie that works on different levels because it hits the generations different. And I would say that that is something I tend to react more. I watch The Exorcist and I react to it as a parent. Whereas when I was a kid, you know, even when I was like 20, I still projected myself in Reagan's shoes, or at the very least being the priest trying to help her out. But, you know, as an adult now, I watch that from Ellen Burstyn's point of view as the parent who's got a child who's got something wrong with him and you can't figure out what it is. And she's willing to try anything. So I guess that would be the big thing. It's not that I get more sensitive, because I always get sensitive to certain things. I get more sensitive to stuff outside of it because I'm so used to there always being some horror movies that disturb me in a certain way to the point I don't want to watch them. But it just, I think with age and maturity, you look at movies differently. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Fall of the House of Usher, which is coming to Netflix on October 12th.
Roderick Usher, your family is a collection of stunted hearts. Whose time has come?
Who are you?
Consequence. And tonight is consequential.
This was no accident. You have been targeted. And this woman knows everything.
It's time, Roderick.
I'm afraid you're ringside for my reckoning, old friend.
I have real mixed views on Mike Flanagan's stuff. And it's not just because he yelled at me on Twitter once because I criticized one of his earlier movies, which is a true story. He came at me on Twitter and I'm like, dude, calm down, man. I mean, I appreciate what you did. I just didn't particularly like the movie. But I respect the heck out of him for making a cottage industry of himself and how well he's endeared himself to Stephen King and doing his adaptations. I mean, I think that's great. I respect that. But I've not particularly liked his miniseries and limited series on Netflix, you know, stuff like The Haunting of Hill House and The Haunting of Blythe Manor. I just find those to be a little bit overbearing and overwrought and overwritten, and they just kind of, it's been a long time since I've read Poe's original story about the House of Usher. But I'm intrigued with this one because this doesn't feel like it's just going to be a rehash of gothic horror that he did in Blythe Manor and Hill House. It looks like he's doing something different. And I'm like, I applaud that. I want to see something different. So yeah, I'm actually looking forward to this one. The next one I want to talk about is Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, which comes to theaters on December 20th.
I'm going to kill Aquaman and destroy everything he holds dear. I'm gonna murder his family and burn his kingdom to ash.
He must be stopped, or a global meltdown is imminent.
I cannot believe you let this happen.
Yeah, well, I hate this job.
True King builds bridges, right?
It's an action movie. You get what you're gonna get. I think Jason Momoa is great in the role. I'm curious to see how well it does, though, in relation to how troubling some of these other DC movies have been. And I would not blame James Wan or Jason Momoa or Patrick Wilson or anybody else involved in this if this isn't a massive hit, because DC is still trying to get its feet under its hips so it can walk like a human being. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Very Short Tracks and Hypnotic. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews. And I want to talk about something that's a little bit odd. It's not something that I normally would talk about, but I'm a fan. Star Trek, Very Short Treks. Now, I know I've been talking a lot about Star Trek lately. It's because you had the big anniversary and you had Star Trek Day recently. And I like the series. I like the fact that growing up, there was the original series, the animated series, and then they started making movies and that was it. And it wasn't until I was even in my teenage years that they brought in The Next Generation. And that took a little bit of time to get some footing. But now there are so many Trek series that it's a playground for a geeky sci-fi fan like myself. And I've said when it comes to streaming services, if you can only afford a couple, you got to get the ones that are important to you. And if you're a Star Trek fan or you're interested in getting into Star Trek, you got to get Paramount Plus because that's got them all, except Star Trek Prodigy, which they're burying. But anyways, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Star Trek the Animated Series, these mini-episodes poke fun at the classic cartoon.
Space, the final frontier.
Star Trek has given us an incredible universe of entertainment. And this year, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Emmy Award-winning Star Trek, the animated series. And we're doing so boldly and briefly.
That's enough silly stories for one night.
With five new animated tributes that are anything but canon. Prepare to be shocked.
What?
Very Short Treks.
They had three seasons of the live-action series back in the 60s. And they never got a fourth season off the ground, but then they did an animated series, Saturday morning cartoon, basically. But when you actually look at the stories, they were using real Star Trek stories. They could have a little more liberty with weird-looking aliens because you didn't have to worry about prosthetics or anything, but it was essentially more Star Trek episodes. And I watched that right after I watched the original series, and I gotta say, it does play like Star Trek Season 4. So what they did is they took that style of animation, because it's the 50th anniversary of that premiering, and did new Star Trek episodes, but they used all the voice cast from the current Star Trek. So like even Spock is done by Ethan Peck. You know, they don't have somebody imitating Leonard Nimoy or anything. And they're silly. They're not meant to be part of what really goes on in the show, because they're insane. They're absurd and they're crazy, and they poke fun at the series, and they poke fun at the silly things going on. And some of them are kind of out there. I mean, like, there's some crass jokes and there's some off color or what could be considered distasteful jokes or uncomfortable humor, dark humor in there. They're available on the Star Trek YouTube page. Just search Very Short Treks on YouTube. You'll find them. And right now there's only two episodes out there. It'll take you less than 10 minutes to watch them both because they're like 4 minutes each. And they're funny. I mean, they're cute. I have a great affinity for them because there was a time where Star Trek fans didn't have any sense of humor. I was at a science fiction convention sometime in the 90s. And at a booth, they were playing the William Shatner Saturday Night Live episode. And he did a great job hosting Saturday Night Live in the 90s. But there's a sketch where he talks at a Star Trek convention and people are asking him absurd questions. And at one point, he's like, guys, get a life. It was a TV show. Move out of your parents' basement. And it was played at the sci-fi convention. And they turned that off. They turned that sketch off. They fast-forwarded through it because it was cutting a little too close to the bone. So at least Star Trek fans have a sense of humor, and it's a little more normalized. It's not the insane crazy people that sometimes it was back in the 70s or 80s or even 90s. These are fun. They're in good humor, not always in good taste. Let's just put it that way. They're custom made for the old school Trek fan. So if you like those old animated series, these contemporary recreations of the style poke fun at the series without stooping to ridicule. I'm going to say that Star Trek Very Short Treks totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to be talking about a movie that's a little bit old. It's actually about 5 months old. It came out in, I think, April. And that is Hypnotic. I never saw it. They didn't screen it. And it came and went from the theaters. It made less than $10 million and pff, it was done. But I was curious to see it because I remember watching the trailer and thinking, well, that looks like it could be fun, but terrible. So it finally dropped on Peacock and I decided to watch it. So I'm going to talk about it here. Ben Affleck stars as a detective facing an enemy who can manipulate how he sees reality.
What makes total strangers pull off an elaborate bank heist? Are you familiar with the concept of hypnotics?
Hypnotics.
Hypnotics have the ability to influence the brain, sound, voice.
Need a light?
Locking eyes. Hypnotics use them to make you see a version of the world that doesn't exist.
Thanks.
It's not him anymore.
Next stop!
I like Ben Affleck as an actor. I think he's phoning it in this one. I feel like he's doing a Kevin Smith movie at this point. It was directed by Robert Rodriguez, and Robert Rodriguez blows so hot and cold. There are some things he does that are actually really quite impressive. And, you know, especially if you go back to his earlier work, you know, not just talking about like El Mariachi, which was an amazing feat of independent guerrilla filmmaking. But, you know, stuff like Sin City was a brilliant movie. Only Robert Rodriguez would have been able to do that. Then there were Imitations, but Rodriguez really broke new ground with that movie. But he has this habit of hiring his family, and that's fine. You know, Nepo babies are a thing in Hollywood. But this was co-written by his son. I think his name is Razor. He helped write the Sharkboy and Lava Girl. And it's funny because on the DVD of that, he's got video footage of them brainstorming what could happen, and they're at their pool. And the kids, and it's really literally the kids are like, let's say that this happened. What if this happens? You know, kids play. They remember doing that. Oh, let's say that I have this superpower. Let's say I have this superpower that does this. And that's kind of what the boardroom sessions for Sharkboy and Lava Girl were. And Racer's an adult now, but I don't know if his writing's any better. So Hypnotic, it feels like an attempt to do a Christopher Nolan movie. And look, I'm about done with Christopher Nolan. I think he's a pretentious windbag, and I don't think his films are as smart as he thinks they are and everybody else does. And one of the things that really annoyed me when Inception came out were the people were like, oh, God, it's so hard to understand. My mind was blown. And like, it's a dream within a dream within a dream. But what was going on? Where were they? Well, you know, each level of the dream looks completely different than the next one. You know, one's a rainy street. The next one's in a boardroom. The next one's in snow. The next one's on the beach. It's pretty easy to tell where they are. Oh, but it's so mind-bending. It is not. It's not. But there is a whole group of people out there that insisted that Inception was just too hard to grasp. And it feels like one of those people wrote this movie. This is predictable and poorly written. And there's things that don't make internal sense. And there's like turns and twists that aren't really turns and twists because they're the only place that this could go. There's no surprises in this movie whatsoever if you have an IQ of 6 or above. It's a whole bag of awful. It's watchable, but it's terrible at the same time. It's a poorly written attempt at cerebral science fiction that collapses under its weight of its own stupidity. It's there telling you, guys, I'm a smart movie. And it's not a smart movie. It's so dumb. This movie's stupid. It totally sucks.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about A Haunting in Venice and Elevator Game. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and do a new one this week that's in theaters. And let's talk about A Haunting in Venice. Supreme Detective Hercule Poirot attends a Halloween seance where a person is mysteriously killed.
Hercule Poirot, I've found something. I am the smartest person I ever met and I can't figure it out, so I came to the second. Come with me to a seance. Spot the con I can't.
Detective, you are here to discredit me, but I can talk to the dead.
Somebody is dead. No one shall leave this place until I know who did it.
A ghost killed her.
There must be a rational answer for all of this.
Kenneth Branagh directed two other Hercule Poirot movies from Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie created the character. Those were Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile. Both of those are much more famous in general pop culture than Agatha Christie's Halloween Party. If you actually go back and look at the contemporaneous reviews of Halloween Party, they're pretty harsh on that. It came out in like the late 60s, and she was pretty old at the time. And I remember reading about somebody saying it sounded like she dictated this and didn't actually edit it. She just sort of like dictated it, and they wrote it up and made the book. So it's not one of her more famous pieces, but it does involve Hercule Poirot. And that gives Kenneth Branagh a chance to do another movie with him and his fabulous mustache. And I liked both Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile. I thought they were interesting adaptations. I thought Kenneth Branagh did a good job giving a new version of it. One of the dangers of Agatha Christie stuff is they've been done to death, no pun intended. I mean, either on the big screen or TV movies, like Peter Ustinov played Hercule Poirot on a couple TV movies. And the British have done a whole bunch of them. They've had a whole series. I have not read extensively Agatha Christie's stuff, so I can't tell you how accurate or how close this is to the original source material. But from what I understand, he took quite a bit of liberties, certainly with the story. I mean, the setting's there. But one of the things that I thought differentiates this is both Orient Express and Death on the Nile were these big, lavish, star-studded movies. They were high budget. They had these very impressive, wide vista-type sets. They had a huge cast, and there were these ensemble pieces, and it kind of got away from him with Death on the Nile because there were some special effects that looked pretty terrible. But this one takes a totally different approach. It takes place on Halloween in Venice, obviously, and they attend this Halloween party, and then they have the seance upstairs. But it all takes place in this one location, this one residence, and there's plenty of rooms that they can go through. But they're all kind of like locked into this area during a storm. And so he leans it more into shooting it like a horror movie. He shoots it with dark corners and shadows and offset lighting and, you know, sort of a choppy bit of an editing. The editing style's not as smooth as what he had in his other movies, because he's putting it together like a horror movie. It's not a horror movie. I mean, it involves a murder and the suggestions of ghosts, but it's not really a horror movie. It is a mystery at its core. So it's fully Agatha Christie style, but it has all these elements of a horror movie. And that makes it kind of interesting. That makes it cool to watch. And I also appreciate the cinematography. Now, I was fortunate enough to see it in a place that had good projection. So it might look like crap in bad projection, because that tends to happen. But there's a lot of things where you lose the background because it all just gets dark. But at least he lights his key players. And I love that. I think that goes back to what he should. It's almost theatrical. And that's where Branagh's background is, as a theatrical director and performer. It's like any Agatha Christie movie. It's like Death on the Nile or Murder on the Orient Express. It'll keep you guessing. It has all these different suspects and all these possibilities. It does drag a bit in the middle. I'm not going to lie. It's slower than it should be. And it's shorter than the other two movies. It's like an hour 43. It's not a particularly long film. One of the dangers of a movie, especially anything that's like an Agatha Christie thing, is stuff tends to be somewhat complicated and things wrap around themselves. That can be confusing for the audience. And because of the low light and because of the limited cast and limited locations, you can sometimes either get fatigued trying to keep up with all the characters or get confused. But with that said, it still was an intriguing movie. I did enjoy it. I was surprised at how much I responded to it. Reminds me a little bit of, you know, have you ever seen the movie Don't Look Now? The one with Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. It also takes place in Venice, I believe. It's sort of this creepy mystery, sort of horror-esque type movie. And it reminds me of that, even though it's a very different type of film, because it takes full advantage of its location. And unlike Death on the Nile, where you have this CGI pyramid in the background, it looks like the guy's going up against a weather blue screen. This thing's all done in generally practical locations, and they play around with stuff. It's not going to be for everybody, and it's kind of walking a tightrope between a horror movie and a mystery. You think that there's a lot of connective tissue, but they don't always cross-pollinate. So that's kind of it's a bold step for him to take. But I did enjoy this one. I mean, it's a little slow, but a slick horror-themed diversion from other Kenneth Branagh's mysteries from Agatha Christie. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Elevator Game. This is available on Shudder. YouTubers who report on urban legends try the elevator game and unleash a malevolent spirit.
I read a story online about a girl who went missing playing the elevator game.
That's the one where you ride an elevator to summon some spirit?
The fifth floor woman.
But if you don't do the game right...
The entire game is real!
When we played the game, we broke a rule.
Open the door, now she's out to get us!
We need to go to the police!
You can't call the cops on a ghost, Chloe!
This is your basic let's test an urban legend movie. And it is just about this group of YouTubers who are struggling to keep their show alive. And they go into the elevator to try this thing. Now, if you've not heard of the elevator game, I mean, I'd heard that it existed mainly because I watched that show Evil on Paramount Plus, and they had an episode devoted to the elevator game on that. And it's actually relatively new. It's within the last 15 years or so. I found a link to it, and I was reading the rules, and I'm like, there's too many rules. It's like, here's what you do. You get on the elevator, you push all these floors, then you do this, and this is how you leave, and this is if you step off. And I'm like, I don't have time to research this. But it's your basic early 20s slasher-type movie, only with a ghost or a spirit of some sort. It's directed by Rebecca McHenry, and she did Glorious. I've not seen Glorious, but it's on my list because I want to compare these two. So there's some really interesting imagery, and there's some really creepy imagery. And again, bucking the trend of what seems to be popular, she at least lights everybody effectively. Even the ghost and the creepiness, you can actually see stuff. It's not murky and gross looking. My biggest problem with this movie is the characters and the dialogue were not good. They make the characters kind of like just all a bunch of a-holes. They're all either cocky or they're making jokes. And you hear that at the end of the trailer where he's like, you can't call the cops on a ghost. It's like, at that moment, I'm like, please kill that guy. I want that character gone. You see that a lot in either independent films or something like that. They misread the cool factor of how they're supposed to come across. And they just come across as annoying. But you have to like your victims. That's what makes them intriguing victims. And that's the one thing that really caused a problem for me is the acting was stilted. And there's some like weird things that don't make sense. And they hint at things that then they never flesh out later. I don't know. The movie itself has some great ideas. It has some great imagery. And it's a very basic, if not terribly complex idea. So it's an occasionally effective spin on a relatively new legend, though it just has some real rough spots in writing and acting. It's not in a fun way, so I'm going to have to say that Elevator Game kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Killing It Season 2 and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Dawn of the Dead. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up these reviews and talk about Killing It Season 2. This is on Peacock. It stars Craig Robinson. If you don't know who he is, he's Daryl from The Office. He also played Doug Judy in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and apparently some of the people involved in Brooklyn Nine-Nine do this show. The second season premiered about a month ago. But I have a publicist who's bugging me about this. So I said, yeah, I'll take a look at it. I got a hole in the schedule for this week. There's enough stuff that people aren't screening that I don't want to talk about, you know. So yeah, I had a chance to check out season 2. Craig Robinson stars as an entrepreneur who struggles to stay above board when criminal elements and shady characters threaten his Saw Palmetto Berry Farm.
There's
started our farm in coastal Florida.
We are thriving here.
We're prepared to purchase her entire crop. What do you say?
The second our business got even a tiny bit of success, people showed up trying to take it.
I want to talk to you about a proposition.
This creepy swamp family, they screwed me over.
We split the profits, 80-20.
Vanessa and Camille are counting on me. My brother keep it above board.
From sun up, sun this is my farm that I own. Shut up!
I never watched the first season, but here's the thing. I like Craig Robinson. I used to not like him, but he's really grown on me watching him show up in a bunch of shows. Part of it is he's got my physique. I feel that Craig Robinson and I could do a product because we look like each other. I mean, we both have the same build and the same belly. Let's just put it that way. And I respect anybody who could be his size and still make it in the industry as much as he has. And he's funny. He's got a tenderness to him. There's a soft spot to this guy that he doesn't always show up in all of the stuff he plays, but you want to like him. That's why in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, when he plays Doug Judy, that's why his character, the Pontiac Bandit, just took off, because him and Jake Peralta were such good friends. And I think that's all attributed to the chemistry between the actors. And that's kind of what makes Craig Robinson work in this. Now, the premise of this essentially is he's trying to do business right. He's trying to be above board and being straight. But throughout his development of his business, every bad thing that can happen to him is happening to him. Everything from a potential snail infestation on his farm to the being blackmailed to dealing with crooks and criminals and these crazy swamp people. And that's kind of like what the first half of the season is. It just piles on, and it gets a little bit rough, because at a certain point you're like, okay, I get it. The guy's suffering. Why do we have to throw more crap at him? And the other thing is he thinks he's made it, but he really hasn't. He's just beginning, and anything can go bad and destroy his business. And so I appreciate this. I appreciate the sympathy and the empathy that this is supposed to evoke in people. It gets a little bit rough after a while, but halfway through the season, it turns and it's him trying to kind of make the most out of it and get the better of the situation. And that's where I find it really started getting interesting. It's a very funny series at times. It's not laugh out loud, constantly funny. Like, say, you know, I've mentioned Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a great comic movie. It's very funny. But this one, it's a little bit more of a slow burn. There's some more stuff going on in the background, but it has these zingers throughout that honestly really made me laugh. But the real heart and soul, aside from Craig Robinson, who's struggling to do the right thing, but he's not he's at least a realist. Claudio Doherty plays Jillian, and she's his Australian business partner. And she's just a big lump of positive energy that gets in his way as well, because she's like, well, you can't just shut the business down. You can't fire this person because we're being nice. And it's a real interesting thing to play good cop, regular cop characters. I mean, he's good, but she's so good, it's almost pathological and problematic. So their chemistry is what makes the show. That's, I think, what really makes it work. And it does write itself into a corner sometimes, and then just sort of like sneaks out through a crack in the wall. But I mean, it's cute. I find it funny. The increasingly silly problems getting a little weighty, but there are some clever moments and genuine character points in here. There's some reality in what the characters do. And I appreciate that, especially as the season wraps up. So I'm going to have to say Killing It Season 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Dawn of the Dead. Like I've said before, I will cover horror movies. I'm a big horror movie fan. In the fall, even in September, I'm doing horror movies. So I'm trying to watch some horror movies in my free time. And this year, I've kind of gone to the mode of saying I'm going to just do rewatches. I'm not going to pick new ones, because some new ones can suck. I'm just going to pick the ones I've seen before and kind of use that as my cinematic comfort food. And I'm not a huge fan of zombie movies, because I think they're overdone. There was a period of time, and it lasted, I swear it lasted from like the 90s through just a couple of years ago, where it was just nonstop. Everybody was doing a zombie movie because that's something that's really easy to do on a budget. And I think there's some interesting stuff to mine from a zombie movie, but sometimes people just don't, and they just make it a zombie movie. So just the presence of zombies doesn't intrigue me. But Dawn of the Dead, it's directed by George Romero. So it's sort of the gold standard of zombie movies, even more so than Night of the Living Dead, as groundbreaking as that was. But let's go ahead and play the trailer for this. George A. Romero's classic tale of the zombie apocalypse follows four survivors who take shelter in a shopping mall.
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
Dawn of the Dead.
Meet me on the roof at 9 o'clock. Get out.
I don't believe
it. We're
going
to get out in the chopper. We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
They kill for one reason. They eat their victims.
Looks like a shopping center. One of those big indoor malls.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
Compared to the Night of the Living Dead, which was much more of that intimate character portrayal of people in a crisis situation, this has much more to say. And it even says so in the trailer, talks about in the trailer. At the end, you hear them, why are they coming to the mall? Well, that's what they used to do. And it's supposed to be this allegory of nonstop consumerism, blind consumerism, zombies marching around, doing whatever they can do to survive just so that they can buy more stuff. And, I mean, it's pretty obvious. When you watch Dawn of the Dead, it's pretty clearly making some statements about society. But it's also a really good movie. I mean, it's not just about its subtext. And the movie starts, whereas the first one starts with a very intimate two people going to visit a grave. This one starts with people they're part of the media. They're part of the TV station that's still trying to stay on the air and have experts talk about what's going on while they're being overrun by zombies. So it has that media approach to it. Whereas the third movie, Day of the Dead, is more about the military-industrial complex and its clash with science. But this Dawn of the Dead is it starts in the media, it continues through consumerism, so it is told through the lens of modern or 1978 version of modern American society. And it's interesting because you get to see people work together and how you can find solace and find a place to be. And if you can put that wall up around yourself while there's chaos outside, but chaos is always waiting to get in and you can't stop chaos completely. Now it's interesting. I went and I watched the remake of Dawn of the Dead by Zack Snyder, which came out in 2004, which I really do enjoy. And I like the fast moving zombies, but I will say this Dawn of the Dead is better. What's weird about it is like, you know where I found it? I found it on streaming. It's on this site called Rediscover Television. Let me read you the description of Rediscover Television on the Roku channel store. Welcome to Rediscover Television, a family friendly television channel bringing you the best in entertainment for all ages. Hello, it's Dawn of the Dead. People are getting their brains cut out. People are shooting children who are zombies. People are getting eaten alive. Yet it says watch content like Looney Tunes, Christian movies, family entertainment, and many more. Somehow when I searched on Roku, it comes up and it came up ad-free. I don't think they advertise that they have Dawn of the Dead, but I think they use that as a gateway, try and get people in there, and then maybe you can watch The Chosen. I don't know. I don't know the thinking behind this, but that's how I found it. And it's worth revisiting if you've not seen it. Dawn of the Dead is still a great historical movie. When I was a teenager in the 80s, I didn't appreciate it as much because I didn't look at it against the cinematic backdrop. But yeah, I mean, this is the granddaddy of all zombie movies with clever social commentary, and it's a high watermark for horror cinema. I'm going to have to say Dawn of the Dead totally rocks. Worth watching this Halloween.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the show. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Expendables 4 and The Continental. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.